The title of today's sermon is The United Nations, Successes and Disappointments. Next Sunday, October 24th, 2010, will be the 65th anniversary of the beginning of the United Nations. The international organization created in 1945 at the end of World War II to replace the League of Nations, which had failed to prevent World War II. U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt felt that the failure of the League of Nations to prevent World War II was largely due to the fact that the United States failed to join that organization. The U.S. did not join the League of Nations, even though it was the idea of U.S. President Woodrow Wilson. Because of Republican opposition in the U.S. Senate, Wilson couldn't get the two-thirds vote he needed to ratify the Versailles Treaty, into which the covenant of the League of Nations had been put. He got a majority vote, but not the two-thirds he needed. National isolationism from the rest of the world was still too strong. In order to prevent a repetition of that mistake, Roosevelt wanted to get the new United Nations organization created and get the U.S. into it before the war ended. He succeeded in doing that. But the UN Charter didn't get the needed ratifications by other countries until October 24th. That is why October 24th is celebrated throughout the world as United Nations Day. It is the day when the United Nations Charter went into effect 65 years ago. Now I want to talk a little bit about the nature of the UN before I get into the successes and disappointments. At present, the United Nations is coordinator and cheerleader for assisting the world to help the neediest, anywhere and everywhere. All over the world, the presence of UN personnel means that help is on the way for needy people in the most difficult situations. Unlike many national governments, the UN is making friends and has a minimum of enemies. There are many people whose lives have been saved by people working for the United Nations. The UN is not a world government, but it can be viewed as a beginning step toward a world government, similar to the way in which, in this country, the Articles of Confederation was a beginning step for the U.S. government, which came into existence with the creation and ratification by the 13 colonies of the U.S. Constitution in the years 1787 and 1788. Note that the Declaration of Independence, 1776, was adopted by the Continental Congress operating under the Articles of Confederation. 13 years before the U.S. national government was created. So which is the beginning of the United States? The Declaration of Independence or the beginning of the Constitution in 1789 when George Washington became our first president? The UN is an association of national governments based on accepting the UN Charter. We read the preamble just a few moments ago. In 1945, when the UN started, there were 51 independent member countries. Now there are 192. Many of them former colonies of the European countries in Africa and Asia. And that's a great change. Notice that the number of members has almost quadrupled from the time when the UN started in 1945. The two policy-making bodies in the UN are the General Assembly and the Security Council. But they are very different in power and membership. In the General Assembly, each country is entitled to one vote, regardless of its wealth and population. Now, members include some mini-states, islands in the Pacific, for example, with populations less than that of the St. Louis metropolitan area. The General Assembly sets the policies of the UN organization itself, such as what its budget should be and how it should be spending the various resources that it has. Beyond that, it can only make recommendations to the national governments. It is not a legislature. It can't make laws. It can't collect taxes. All money comes from allocated contributions from the national governments, and they don't always pay what they're supposed to. The General Assembly also can organize international conferences and can direct the activities of the UN employees. The UN's main offices are in New York City and in Geneva, Switzerland. But there are UN employees stationed throughout the world doing humanitarian work, peacekeeping work, and so on. Many of the people who work at the UN headquarters in New York, including the national representatives, the ambassadors from the different countries, are the employees not of the UN, but of the many national governments involved. But the Security Council is the locus of real power. Theoretically, every member nation of the UN is obliged to abide by resolutions adopted by the Security Council. The Security Council is composed of representatives from 15 countries. 5 of these countries are the biggest countries on the winning side of World War II. Remember, the UN Charter was put together before the war ended. So it was the 5 big powers in World War II that were given permanent status on the Security Council, namely the United States, Britain, or officially called the United Kingdom, Russia, France, and China. These 5 are the permanent members of the Security Council, and each of these countries has the power to cast a veto. That prevents a resolution from being adopted even if all of the other 14 representatives support it. A lot of power for those 5 countries to keep things from happening. The other 10 countries on the Security Council are elected to be there by the General Assembly for 2-year terms. 5 are elected every other year. Because of the veto power of the permanent 5, the Security Council couldn't do very much during the Cold War because of the opposition between the United States and Russia, both of whom had vetoes. And presently, it cannot do much either to rein in the Big 5 or their allies and trading partners. The U.S. has used the veto many times to protect Israel. And other countries like Sudan get protected by China because China needs their oil. So if any one of those 5 countries wants to keep something from happening, they can keep it from happening. The other main body of the UN is the Economic and Social Council, which consists of representatives from 54 countries. And it is responsible for the coordination of economic, social, and related work of 14 UN specialized agencies, its functional commissions, and 5 regional commissions. The Economic and Social Council is in charge of much of the UN's humanitarian and human rights activity. An important related institution, also created in 1945 at the end of World War II, is the International Court of Justice, often called the World Court, which is located in The Hague in the Netherlands. It adjudicates legal disputes between national governments, but only if they agree in advance to abide by the court's judgment, because the court has no way of enforcing its judgments. It just makes judgments, but that's, it can't enforce them. The Security Council would have to do that. One success for the International Court of Justice was establishing a boundary for catching fish between the American and Canadian fishermen in the Gulf of Maine. This was a difficult problem because the fishermen in both countries wanted their government get more land, more ocean space for us, get more ocean space for us. And so both countries, United States and Canada, said, let's just take it to the International Court of Justice, and whatever they say, we'll solve it. And that is how that problem was solved. No talk of war, although for a little while it looked like there might be, but it got solved by the International Court of Justice. The UN system, which is more than just the United Nations itself, the UN system includes 18 other international organizations, such as the World Health Organization, the Universal Postal Union, the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization called UNESCO, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank Group of five banking organizations, such as the International Finance Corporation, and so on. If the UN were a government, these international organizations would be its departments. So we think of our own US government, and we think about the cabinets and the different departments, and these international organizations are like the departments of a world government, except there isn't any world government. On the successes of the UN, let me first mention the UN's strategy for stopping aggression, which is called collective security. If the Security Council adopts a resolution identifying an aggressor, all member states are supposed to make their military forces available to fight against that aggressor. The first time the Security Council did this was in 1950, when communist North Korea attacked non-communist South Korea. The result was the Korean War, in which the UN's military forces, under the command of US General Douglas MacArthur, wore UN insignia, used UN helmet liners, and fought back from what looked like defeat to a standoff after communist Chinese troops came into the war to help the almost defeated North Korea. At considerable cost and with much controversy, the US-led UN forces stopped the attempted takeover of South Korea by the North. There was a lot of complaining in this country about that Korean War. Why are we involved in a war in Korea? But in view of what is now happening in Korea, that UN response to North Korea's aggression looks like a very important success, especially for the people of South Korea, who without that battle would be part of North Korea, and we all know the disaster which is taking place in North Korea. So was the Korean War worth it? I think so. The second time the Security Council acted to stop aggression was in 1990 and 91, the end of 90 and the beginning of 91. It was in response to the effort by Iraq's Saddam Hussein to take over UN member state Kuwait by military force. Saudi Arabia was also threatened. The UN authorization for the US-led effort, known as the First Gulf War, was possible because the Soviet Union was no longer using its veto to stop UN action. This 1991 war against Iraq was legitimized by the UN Security Council, but unlike Korea, it was fought by a coalition of military forces led and coordinated by the United States, but not wearing UN uniforms and UN stamped tanks and so on. So those are the two main times when the UN has stopped aggression. The United States sought to get UN Security Council approval for additional military action against Iraq at the end of 2002 and beginning of 2003 on grounds that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction that were being hidden from the International Atomic Energy inspectors. But the U.S. failed to persuade the French and the Russians, who have veto power. So we knew we couldn't get a resolution through the Security Council. When the U.S.-led forces attacked Iraq, it was without UN legitimation. And consequently, under international law, this military attack by the United States against Iraq constituted aggression, one of the things the UN is supposed to halt. One of the great successes of the UN as a factor in preventing war was the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. Those of you who lived through that will not forget it. For 13 years, the whole world held its breath to see if there would be a nuclear holocaust as the U.S. and the Soviet Union unleashed their thousands of nuclear warheads on each other. The diffusing of the situation occurred in private talks, but also in the public appeals to world opinion being made at the United Nations. Many of you will remember Adlai Stevenson was our spokesperson in that very important debate. On October 15th, 2001, shortly after 9/11, the United States did get authorization by the UN Security Council Resolution 1267 to make the Taliban in Afghanistan stop providing a place for terrorist training and to turn Osama bin Laden over to appropriate national authorities who can prosecute him. In other words, although the action in Iraq is not sanctioned by the UN Security Council, the action in Afghanistan is sanctioned by the UN Security Council. The UN has been instrumental in advancing conferences and treaties on arms control, on the rights of women and children, on preserving the environment, on the issue of AIDS, on the issue of controlling other contagious diseases, addressing population growth, considering the human rights, especially of refugees and minorities, the advancing of the governance of the oceans and outer space, and other global problems. These international conferences were called by the General Assembly, not the Security Council. In my view, one of the most important recent developments resulting from the actions of the General Assembly was the holding of the 1998 conference in Rome, which adopted a treaty to establish a permanent international criminal court which can prosecute individuals. That's different from the International Court of Justice. International Court of Justice can only take action against national governments. The International Criminal Court is to prosecute individuals, even government and military leaders, for the crimes of genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and ethnic cleansing. The jurisdiction of this International Criminal Court began in 2002, and some high-ranking persons have been indicted, including the president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, the first time in human history that the sitting head of state has been indicted by an international court for ordering the massacres of large numbers of innocent persons in Darfur. I think most of you have heard about what went on in Darfur, and Bashir was responsible for it. The International Criminal Court could be even more effective than it is if the United States government would wholeheartedly support it, instead of being so concerned about possible indictment of U.S. political leaders and military personnel. My attitude is, if Americans commit these kinds of crimes, I want them indicted, even if they're Americans. I don't care if it's an international court. If they're doing these kinds of criminal actions, let's have them arrested. Let's not worry about whether Americans are being prosecuted by an international court. The UN has sent in peacekeeping forces to maintain peace agreements in tense areas. At present, there are still 14 ongoing peacekeeping missions, and 51 peacekeeping missions have actually been completed. That means in 65 years, there have been 65 peacekeeping missions, average one a year. An important success of the UN has been the supervising of the decolonization of most of Africa and the other parts of the world. Rather than needing to fight a war to become an independent country, former colonies could get their independence recognized by becoming a member of the United Nations. And so we had the peaceful independence of many former colonies because of the UN. The UN also has been much more successful in efforts of nation building than has the U.S. government. One of the most successful of these UN operations was in Namibia, what formerly known as Southwest Africa, in 1989-90, where a country which had been subjected to apartheid by South Africa adopted a democratic constitution with UN assistance, and even showed South Africa how to have a racially integrated society. I myself think that what happened in Southwest Africa in Namibia was an important factor in what happened in South Africa later. In El Salvador, in 1991 to 95, the UN negotiated a ceasefire between government and rebel forces, accomplished substantial disarmament, and instituted numerous government reforms in respect to human rights, land reform, and other economic and social issues. In Cambodia, 1992-93, the UN supervised the implementation of the Paris Peace Accords related to human rights monitoring in Cambodia, the repatriation of refugees, and the holding of elections. In Mozambique, in East Africa, 1992-94, the U.S. was in charge of the implementation of peace agreements, the withdrawal of foreign troops, the provision of technical assistance, and the monitoring of elections. In the East Slavonia region of Croatia, part of the former Yugoslavia, 1996-98, UN personnel supervised demilitarization, the return of refugees, creation of a police force, restoration of civil administration and public services, and the holding of an election. The question I have to have in my mind, why not let the UN go in and help more in Iraq and Afghanistan? Why do we think the United States has to do it? Why don't we turn it over to the United Nations? They have shown they can do it. The UN has received favorable publicity with regard to its good handling of relief in the cases of tsunamis, floods, and earthquakes, Haiti and so on, Indonesia. When disaster strikes, poor countries can look to the UN to coordinate relief efforts. It's not the UN does it all. The UN coordinates the work of many other non-governmental or civil society organizations. The UN system provides for continuous collection and publication of statistics and information that are necessary to understand the state of the world as a whole and of the countries in the world. The existence of the UN means that leaders and policymakers of various countries get a chance to talk with each other informally in New York without needing to travel long distances, something which is especially helpful for the smaller, poorer countries of the world who otherwise would be just left out of any kinds of discussions about global issues. Even though the main power in the UN is in the Security Council, the General Assembly has recently taken some major steps. In September 2005, the UN General Assembly convened a world summit that brought together the heads of most member states. The World Summit outcome document delineated the conclusions of the meeting. One of the most important conclusions was the agreement to commit billions of dollars to achieving the Millennium Development Goals. This has received a little bit of publicity. A lot of the rest, I'm sure some of you are thinking, why haven't I heard more about what the UN has been doing? And it's a huge failure of our media not to publicize more about what the UN is doing. The 8 Millennium Development Goals are: 1, eradicate extreme poverty and hunger; 2, achieve universal primary education throughout the world; 3, promote gender equality and empower women. And we're talking here about what's going on in the whole world, not just the United States. 4, reduce child mortality rate; 5, improve maternal health; 6, combat HIV/AIDS, malaria, and other diseases that are rampant in the less developed countries; ensure environmental sustainability; and 8, develop a global partnership for economic development. That is, get the rich countries helping the poor countries. The idea is that the richer countries have an obligation to help the poor countries deal with these difficult problems. Unfortunately, the current global economic crisis is hurting the implementation of this effort. Countries committed a lot of money in 2005 and 2006. Now the economic situation has changed, and they're not so ready to live up to their commitments. Another very important part of the 2005 World Summit outcome document was the unanimous agreement that individual states, with the assistance of the international community, have the responsibility to protect everyone living within their borders from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity, and that the international community is to act collectively in a timely and decisive manner to protect vulnerable civilians if some country should manifestly fail in fulfilling its responsibility. Think back to what happened during the Holocaust, and you understand why this is so important. Because at that time, the argument was national governments can do whatever they want within their borders. Now, this is an explicit rejection of that traditional view in international law that a national government could do whatever it wants without limitation within its national borders. This responsibility to protect, or if you want to look it up in Google, R2P principle, says that certain human rights must be protected by national governments, and that the international community has a right to intervene to protect individuals if their own national government else to do it. Help for the UN comes from many civil society organizations, previously called non-governmental organizations. In trying to deal with global problems, the UN gets important assistance from these civil society organizations. In humanitarian crises, The UN is often coordinating the efforts of these international civil society organizations, such as the International Red Cross, Crescent, Doctors Without Borders, Amnesty International, and so on. The UN General Assembly has been taking measures to get more input from these civil society organizations. Civil society organizations are also important in influencing national governments to support the UN and its humanitarian work. Among these are the United Nations associations in various countries, Citizens for Global Solutions, religious and morally oriented organizations, and many other organizations. But one such civil society organization working to support the UN is our own denomination's UUUN office, located in New York, very close to the UN itself. In your bulletin today is a flyer with the notation you use at the UN, your gateway to the world, along with an envelope for you to join our effort. Bruce Knotts, who served in the State Department's Foreign Service for 23 years, is our executive director. A really well-informed person is in charge of our work. One of his goals is to make UUs familiar with the existence of the UUNO. "We suffer from anonymity," he said. Quote, "People really don't know us, and that's partly because a lot of people don't know about the UN," unquote. Knotts believes that the UN has been portrayed in the United States as an ineffective organization. Then quoting him again, "That is not the perception of the UN in most of the rest of the world. Part of what I want you used to know is that the UN is an important and effective organization for peace and development and humanitarian aid," end of quote. Knotts' respect for the UN is based on his own experience. Quoting him again, "I think the UN operation in Sierra Leone, where I was one of the most successful it had. When I first went there in 2000, 95% of the country was held by rebels. The UN played a huge role in Sierra Leone in creating the conditions for peace and then rebuilding the country when the war was over," and end of quote. He also praised the UN for its role in coordinating relief after the 2004 Pan-Asian tsunami. I am the UUUNO envoy for our congregation. This is something that the UUUN office sets up, envoys for particular congregations. As an envoy, part of my job is to get more of you to join and support the organization. I'm expected as envoy to get at least 5 new members each year, as well as getting this congregation to become a congregational member of the UUUN office, which requires a $100 contribution each year. If you join the UUUN office, you will know more about what the UN is doing, as well as more about the work being done by the UUUN office. You will get a newsletter. You can also go to their website. Now I want to talk about disappointments about the United Nations. My biggest disappointment with the United Nations is not with the UN, but with the lack of support from this country for the UN during much of the past 30 years. At the beginning of 1945, the biggest supporter of the UN and its ideals was the United States, under the leadership of US Presidents Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman. It was the United States that got the UN going, including providing the ground and building for its headquarters in New York City. It was the U.S. that provided the financial resources to get the UN up and running. At the beginning, we provided maybe half of the UN budget. But remember, Europe was destroyed by World War II. The world was in a sad mess. So the United States was one of the few places that had resources. It was the United States that led the fight for the adoption of the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, which was adopted on December 9, 1948. Although the United States Senate did not vote for ratification of that treaty until 40 years later. So the difference between the U.S. leadership in 1945 and the lack of U.S. leadership after that is pathetic. It was the United States and Eleanor Roosevelt that led the UN General Assembly to adopt the Universal Declaration of Human Rights the following day, that is December 10th, 1948. And December 10th is still celebrated as Human Rights Day. It was the United States that led the United Nations to become engaged military to stop the North Korean communists from taking over South Korea. It was the United States, along with the Soviet Union, that led the effort for national independence for former colonies. It was the United States that supported UN international conferences to deal with global problems, such as controlling population growth and protecting the rights of women and children. That was until the early 1980s, when the Reagan administration refused to help fund these international conferences anymore. So from then on, our support for the UN has been very much less. Even the first President Bush, who had been a US ambassador to the UN, was very supportive of the UN and used the UN to reverse the Iraqi aggression against Kuwait that I earlier talked about. He even spoke of the New World Order, which had come into being because the Soviet Union was no longer using vetoes to stop UN action. Unfortunately, his son led an attack against the UN by trying to appoint to the UN as our ambassador John Bolton, a man who had throughout his life taken shots at the UN. He was an enemy of the UN, and Bush was appointing him to be our ambassador to the UN. Bush also cut our financial support to the UN and carried out this military attack against Iraq, even though he couldn't get the support of the UN Security Council to do it. This second President Bush also led an effort to undermine the newly created International Criminal Court that I talked to you about, which in fact would have provided another means for removing Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq. He didn't have to attack Iraq. All he had to do was use the International Criminal Court to go after Saddam Hussein had used poison gas. He could have been convicted of war crimes. President Obama is trying to get the U.S. back to its earlier position of supporting multilateralism and the rule of law at the global level, and even the elimination of all nuclear weapons. But he is being thwarted by Republicans in the U.S. Senate, just as Woodrow Wilson was unable to get support for U.S. ratification of the Versailles Treaty to join the League of Nations. Another source of disappointment with regard to the UN is the manner in which national governments, not just the US government, but all the national governments, continue to be so focused on national interests that they seem unable to act in terms of what can and should be done to deal with global problems. Several national governments have policies to promote population growth in their countries, regardless of the fact that we have a global population problem. They want more people in their country, and that means more people in the world. UN peacekeeping is done mainly by poorly trained military forces from the poor countries, who use it as a way of gaining troops, gaining training for their troops, and making money for their national governments, because they don't pay their soldiers as much as the UN pays them for the peacekeeping forces. So that's why Pakistan and Fiji, can you imagine? Fiji, the island in the Pacific, is one of the biggest providers of UN peacekeepers because it's a good money-making thing for them. What this situation shows is that the UN as an association of national governments lacks a more global outlook that could be taken by having a UN Parliamentary Assembly and an individually recruited UN Peace Force and a more influential International Criminal Court and a separate source of funds, such as a tax on international currency exchanges, the so-called Tobin tax, that would give them a source of income other than contributions from the national governments. Many countries, including the United States, keep the UN weak by keeping it poor. The total budget for the UN is less than $2 billion a year for the whole world. Another source of disappointment with regard to the UN is the veto power of the permanent members of the Security Council. It makes no sense that Russia and France have this power, while Japan and Germany, the second and third largest contributors to the UN budget, and India, the second most populous country in the world, do not. They're not permanent members. The voting system must be changed. But that doesn't happen because nothing can be changed in the UN Charter without the approval of the same Security Council where those five countries have a veto. A way must be found to change the UN Charter or a new organization will need to be formed. Obviously, more could be said about the disappointments of the UN. For example, not all the peacekeeping efforts have been successful. But certainly on balance, it's better to have this international organization addressing world problems than not to have it. A final statement. Please join the UN office as our way of helping the UN to become better and helping ourselves to become better informed.